And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am David.
And today, joining us, we have two special guests. First, this is my friend Damon.
Hello, nice to meet you all.
And we have a long history from back in the old country when we used to farm Nene Goose, the old country being Hawaii in this context.
Ooh.
And then our other special guest for today is Bob.
With 100% less singing.
Aww.
You say that, but that was becoming a feature.
Was it?
Yeah, it's kind of your
time. No,
it's kind of your shtick now, though, isn't it?
There's only the two times I did. One was the very first episode, Orin and I did together. Then there was the insurrection episode.
Look, if it happens three times, it's enemy action. All right. So,
okay.
All right. So, Damon, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background with Star Trek?
Well, I probably saw my first episode of the original series when I was very young and didn't quite understand its cultural importance, but once The Next Generation came out, I think I was around 8 years old, I started watching that religiously, and I was hooked immediately. Post-scarcity, secular humanist utopia, where do I sign up? You know, I just love the vision, the technology, the exploration, and, everything about it was just the best science fiction anything I've ever watched. So, then, of course, I watched, Deep Space Nine and Voyager. Honestly, I didn't really get into Enterprise because I was in Japan at the time when it came out.
You didn't miss much.
That's a good excuse. That's a good excuse, Damon. I was
not in the country. I just, sorry. But, yeah.
And as everyone knows, there is no Star Trek in Japan.
Well, there is.
They are a science fiction free country, as we all know.
That does not explain the giant robot on Damon's avatar on Skype.
Oh, yeah, it's. But, it's kind of interesting. The original series was ported into Japan. It was called Uchu Senryaku, which is like space strategy or something like that. And,
The strategy is what you first think of when you think of Star Trek.
Yeah, well, they kind of missed the point of what it was supposed to be when they translated it, but whatever. It's not really big over here, but I have met some people who are really hardcore Trekkies over here, so that's kind of interesting.
They go hardcore fan-wise in all directions over there, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Dang.
There was recently a big news story that there was going to be this special, Japanese website that was going to have all this information about Star Trek. And I was kind of like, I was looking at it, I was like, this stuff is all already on Memory Alpha. Like, maybe they should just translate Memory Alpha, and then we'd be good to go.
Yeah.
Now, as some of you may or may not know, I live in Seattle, and so does Bob. And Bob has a story about Seattle he wants to tell you.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
This is your idea, Bob.
Yeah, this happened yesterday. I've been on this diet where I've been on this huge thing where I'm trying to not drink coffee and stuff. So I finally broke yesterday.
In Seattle? Seriously?
I know, right? I seriously needed a cup of coffee. So I went to a Starbucks and I'm dressed down. I'm ready to go to work. And I walk in and I'm ordering my cup of coffee. And this guy comes up to me. It's just like, you've got balls. I'm like, what? What do you mean? He's like, no, you've got balls. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, look around. I look around. I'm not really sure what I'm looking for at first. And he's like, you're wearing red. I was like, yeah, everyone here is wearing blue. And I still wasn't connecting. I was just like, I'm not sure what you're on about, sir. And it's like, what are you on about? It's like, it's Seahawks pride.
Oh,
and red is actually I'm not really a big football fan. Apparently red's like a 49ers color. So there was me, Bob, standing in a Starbucks filled with people that were wearing blue or some type of Seahawks regalia of some sort. And I was the only guy in there wearing red and stuck out like a sore thumb. And indeed, as I looked around, there were people looking at me and whispering. It wasn't very comfortable, needless to say. So I got my coffee and left. But what I find interesting really more so about that is that never before have I seen this sort of, fandom before we actually had a shot at the Super Bowl. Before it was just like, whatever. But now this year it's just like, hey, we've got a shot at the Super Bowl. And oh man, I'm, it's like I'm stepping into gang territory, I'm wearing the wrong colors.
Yeah. It happens like every year around football season in the Seattle area. There's like this whole, yeah, Seahawks, what did you think about the game last night mentality, like wherever you go. And so I was just kind of like, I don't know, I'm not big. It's usually something you just shrug off.
I was never approached about what I was wearing in any locale. I was just like, you're wearing 49ers colors. Just like, why? Okay.
Look, it's easy to be a fan when your team's going to the Super Bowl, okay?
Guys. Bunch of posers.
All right, so...
It's a little bit like not wearing green on St. Patrick's Day in Boston. It's a little scary.
Well, it's also easy to be a Star Trek fan when you have TNG and DS9, but you try Voyager and Enterprise and see where the real Trekkies are.
I tried my best to love Voyager. I really gave it a shot.
I'm pretty sure that was a jab at the entire AT&T staff.
Just like, Orin, you're a bad Trekkie because you don't like Voyager and Enterprise. I'm like, oh.
But then that all shifted when we had the JJ, so now everybody kind of likes Voyager and Enterprise, and all the scorn goes to the JJ Trek.
Hey now, let's not go that direction.
Uh-oh.
Hey now,
Speaking of the JJ verse, Orin, you posted something on the All Things Trek Facebook that was like this gender bend comic.
Oh yeah, I did.
Yeah, it looks like it could be fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's an alternate universe gender bend comic set in the alternate gender bend JJ universe, I think, if I've got this chain of alternate universes correct.
We put an AU in your AU.
Yo, dog.
And so, I mean, but I was thinking about, I mean, there was some other kind of, you know, nonsense that was going on with it that you're posting about, but I really thought that it was, you know, that would actually have been a really, really great idea. I mean, I wouldn't probably gender bend the entire cast, but I would definitely, you know, like Captain Kirk being a woman, I think that would have been a great idea, a great way for the JJ-verse to, you know, set itself apart and go, yeah, or something else.
The whole Starbuck on BSG.
It would have definitely set it apart as an alternate timeline.
Yeah. Well,
the more I think about it, the more I just wish they had gone for an actual reboot instead of just pretending it's not a reboot, because, like, they pretend it's not a reboot, but nothing in their universe makes sense if you say it's not a reboot. Whereas if it was a reboot, I wouldn't care, because it's a reboot. It's like, doesn't matter that Chekhov is the wrong age, or that, you know, what's her name, Carol Marcus is completely in the wrong career path if it's a reboot. But apparently it's not a reboot. It's an alternate timeline. None of that makes sense anymore. And originally I didn't really care about that alternate comic, because I don't care about Star Trek comics. But then, like, there was a whole bunch of people being really misogynist at the idea of a gender-bending alternate universe comic book. And I was like,
yeah,
all right.
People were kind of flipping out, and there was some really messed up language that was just kind of getting tossed around in the comments section on there. Like, there was one guy who's like, oh, well, this looks like the sort of thing the femtards will really like. And it's like, excuse me? Do you really think that is appropriate language? And is that really how you see female Star Trek fans? Look, you literally use the phrase femtard.
Look, sometimes Star Trek fans need to be reminded that we are supposed to enjoy the idea of an egalitarian future where everyone's equal.
You'd think so, right? Yeah.
Just as long as there aren't people, female fans of that idea, right?
I mean, on the bright side, my Facebook post commenting on all of that, like, you know, bullcrap misogyny has the most likes of any Facebook post I've ever made. So, you know, good for me, yeah, right?
Orin hates misogyny. 5,000 likes.
Facebook Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
All right, so.
But the comic does look like it could be a lot of fun. I liked the artwork, and I was weirdly distracted by Kirk's enormous flowy hair.
Yeah, it, like, does. Go ahead.
There ain't no hairstyle regulations for Kirk. She don't have to pull that back. She just has got it all going around like a big auburn halo.
It's not as ridiculous as what Yeoman Rand had in the original series, so I say go for it, you know?
Nope, that's part of why I liked it.
You know, if you could wear that giant whatever that was that she was wearing.
Basket hair.
You can wear whatever you want, okay?
That's why her hair is so big, it's full of secrets.
So, speaking of... Okay.
And that was your Mean Girls reference for the day.
That's going to be the next RPG character I ever make. It's going to be spy themed and hide everything in their hair.
You know, why not? speaking of which, you know, segue very smoothly into our actual topic for today, which is Star Trek role-playing games. Because, yeah.
What about your emails?
We don't have any emails. Emails are a thing of the past.
Okay.
At least this week they are.
We've moved past the...
Last week.
We did get an audio file from Data Logan, but because of shenanigans, I wasn't actually able to listen to it yet, so I will add that to the recording, and you guys will all get to hear what Data Logan thinks of us. And if you want to hear more, tune in next week. He'll be joining us, so that'll be fun.
Oh, wow.
And I know Bob and I did an episode on this topic, like, way back in the day, like, you know, episode, like, 20 or something was us talking about Star Trek role-playing games, but I feel like enough time has passed that we should revisit that topic. And that's part of the reason I brought Damon on, because he is a very veteran GM, and it's actually basically the reason I GM the way I do right now, because before I played in Damon's
you.
Game...
You're the reason for all my pain and misery.
We can all blame Orin.
No, it's Damon's fault. Damon made
Damon's
me...
fault. He's Damon... the reason for all the pain and suffering I suffer at Orin's hands.
He you say that, but I'm still going to keep blaming Orin. It's more fun that way.
Because, I mean, to be fair, though, with all of Orin's books and graphic novels and things like that, I think he will be, if he has not already, surpassing me as a storyteller, so I had better step up my game.
Look, Damon, you get that online game running, I will play in it. But, because, I mean, before I played in Damon's game, the idea that you could have a, like, an actual story told in a role-playing game was only something I had considered in, like, the philosophical. It was a hypothetical idea. And, you know, then I played in Damon's game.
Is it possible?
And it was like, hey, this is actually a really interesting story that I care about, and this character I'm invested in beyond my ability to blow things up. And, you know, so that's my background in role-playing right there.
And then everyone died in the end of that first campaign, and it was glorious.
That was great, right? Because then we played the second campaign and we won, it really mattered to us.
That's a really good way of instilling the fear of God in your players, just from the get-go. I approve of your fear-mongering tactics.
What it also told us is not to trust players who keep secrets, but that's another story for another time.
Or have big hair?
or have big hair.
Is that why I don't play with you anymore, oh God?
Grace, you don't play with it anymore because you live in Tacoma, okay? If you lived here, I would love to have you in more of my games.
I'd like to have bigger hair, personally, but okay.
Well, that's fair.
How did that choice come up, bigger hair playing an Orin's game?
Look,
secrets.
I have...
Secrets.
You have to right. pay extra points to get that bigger hair.
I don't even know anymore.
Look, bigger hair is mad broken, okay? But, all right, so the first topic, the first thing I wanted to talk about in this topic, basically, is what system are you going to use if you're going to be playing a Star Trek role-playing game?
D20.
I hate you, Bob.
I gotta go make a thing.
There are two official Star Trek role-playing games. I guess three, because there's the FASA stuff, but that's really old school. So there are two more modern ones kind of floating around right now. There's Last Unicorn and Decipher. And Damon, I know you have some experience with the Decipher system. How does it play?
It's not terrible. It's better than a D20 system. I'd say in overall mechanics, even though it kind of does borrow a lot of the conventions, like you've got these stats, and the stats don't actually mean anything. It's the modifiers that you get from the stats, and you add those to a dice roll, and then you know that's how you pass the skill test. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about the Decipher games is, first, the dice mechanics are 2d6 instead of a d20, which I find very superior because it's a better, it's a more even curve. And if you roll two sixes, then you can roll another d6, so it's kind of like the exploding dice mechanic of Legend of the Five Rings or my game. So that's nice. And also the books in general, there's a lot of good information, so you don't have to be like a walking encyclopedia of Trek, you know, in order to run a game. They lay out a lot of good stuff for you.
I mean, the Last Unicorn system is interesting in that it's sort of similar in that they have it's a D6 system, but instead of even just 2D6, it's like it's a pool of dice. Like, you roll a number of dice equal to your stat, which I've always appreciated just from a mathematical standpoint. I think it generates a better range of numbers. It makes flukes a little bit less likely. So you don't have the D20 problem of 5% of the time you will always humiliate yourself because you roll a 1. And it's like, you know, I'm super good at this, but there's a 5% chance I will just completely flub it. But even so, the Last Unicorn system is a little bit hard to recommend just because it's very easy to break.
And at the same time, are we talking Last Unicorn like the book and the Mia Farrow movie Last Unicorn?
We can only hope. Last Unicorn is the name of the publishing company. Which is out of business currently. I should have made that more clear.
It's kind of excited really for a minute there.
Yeah, they've...
It's a system so modern they don't make it anymore.
Wow. We could be the hippest of the nerd hipsters.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Okay, hear me out, all right?
Star
Trek role-playing is like the perfect storm of geekiness. It's like the two nerdiest things you could ever imagine converging into like a naked singularity of nerddom.
Naked singularity, that's a good phrase.
Like a black hole without the event horizon?
Yes, exactly. I don't know how it works. It's all theoretical.
All right.
Which is perfect for a start. See, I just made it nerdier.
So just to be clear on this,
on the back, sir.
Just to be clear on this, Damon, is naked singularity like an actual scientific term, or did you just make that up? Because either way,
it is an actual scientific term. Yeah, it's a black hole without an event horizon, which seems contradictory because.
Wouldn't that mean it would be pulling?
So.
Wouldn't that mean it would pull in everything? If I understand.
Getting even nerdier right now.
It's theorized that that's what the Romulans use.
Damon.
They're artificial.
Damon. All you gotta do is just say E equals MC squared Adam, and he'll just club away.
That is very easy. E equals MC squared. Yeah.
Ah!
It's all you gotta do, Adam, and he's easily confused.
But I think I was trying to mention that the problem with the Last Unicorn system is that it's very, very easy to break. Like, my brother made a character named Ensign Keegan. I don't know if you remember this guy, Bob. But because it turns out that, like, three really important skills are all based off of intelligence, he just, like, super boosted his intelligence, and he was the ultimate engineer, science officer, and, like, I think he had social sciences, so he was also a social character.
This is the game I was in?
Yeah.
Who was playing that character?
Hmm?
Who was playing that character?
That was my brother, Ari.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Like, literally, he could not fail roles. And the other weird problem with it is that you have to pay points for your rank. So if you want to be the captain, you have to be less capable than everybody else.
Well, you went around that, though, as I recall, is that you just assigned everyone, all the players, ranks, as I recall, and then points accordingly.
I did do that. I broke the rules a little bit, which is, you know, something that I always recommend, right? If you're playing an RPG and there's a rule that doesn't work, I always recommend that you just ignore it or change it instead of trying to play your game around it.
That's usually best.
Do you remember how the Decipher system assigns ranks? Is it just, like, just decide who's captain and who isn't?
The way the book does it, if you want to be in command, then you have to take a, what is it? What do they call it? Not a perk or a gift, an advantage, that kind of thing. You know, you don't actually pay points, but it's one of the things that you can choose, a little bonus during character creation. So it doesn't really penalize your stats, and if you are a command officer, you get to give all of your subordinates mad bonuses. So, I mean, if you want to look at it from a strict power gaming perspective, you are denying yourself, like, some other small thing, like, oh, do more unarmed damage, or better at this kind of social role, you know, those kind of bonuses, but, yeah, it's not so bad.
I won't put all my points into body throw.
No, double, drop kick, running drop kick, that's
the drop kick.
The double hammer fist, we all know that's the way to go.
I distinctly remember in the Decipher books, they described that move under the unarmed combat system. You clasp your hands together, wrapping your fingers around each other, and hammer them down on the enemy's back, miraculously not breaking your fingers and doing damage to the opponent somehow.
Because why not?
Yeah.
As my favorite is when, like, Kira does that move on, like, Damar in a fight that they're having, and Damar is, like, wearing this kind of metal armor thing. And I'm just like, oh my god. I hope that didn't hurt Nana Visitor's hands. And so those are two systems that you can use. And I'm not, you know, we're not going to get too much farther into the nitty gritty of the rules, because if you haven't read them, that won't mean anything to you. But another system.
You mentioned, But hold on, are those two, I know you mentioned the FOSSA, but are those two systems that were like published as Star Trek role-playing games, or are you adapting that system and, you know, creating your own RPG out of it?
No, those are both official licensed Star Trek games. They're both out of print right now, so they're a little harder to find. But by the same token, you can acquire them on the high seas guilt-free. Because, you know, you can't buy them anyway. You just asked about, like, systems that could be adapted. There are a couple that I would recommend if you're really into the idea of the role-playing game part of it. I would recommend Burning Empires, which is a system I really like.
Ooh,
Yeah, you played in the Burning Empires game of mine, Grace.
Oh, yeah, I played in multiple ones. I played both Burning Empires and your own personally adjusted versions of the Burning Empires system.
And it's got, like, this really interesting, like, life path system, and, like, the tech creation rules are really handy for Star Trek. It does require a lot of work, because the life paths are all designed for this dystopian future where everyone is ruled by feudal lords. So you need to kind of change that a bit if you want to have it set in the Federation. But if you're willing to put in the work, that's totally worth it. And then my other recommendation is Mouse Guard. And I'm serious about that. I am not joking.
Mouse Guard.
And the only reason for that is because Mouse Guard, the actual system, is incredibly flexible and also incredibly easy to use and really dynamic. So if you just strip out all the places where it says mouse, and just put in, you know, Starfleet officer, and it works out just fine.
Have either of you or any of you heard of or played with, messed around with the Hero gaming system? That was one that my brother really got into, and they have, like, set games and you know, the Ninja book series or this one. But he was able to adapt it. Basically, he had a Matrix version, and then he had a Star Trek, and it kind of seemed like the superhero version is Champions. That's where we get the Champions Online thing later, but the Hero gaming system, it kind of seemed to be a core system, and then they said, make any kind of role-playing game you want. You could be pirate, you could do this, that, and the other thing, because it was mainly about, like, the core system of the math and the points, and, you know, you could make it powers, you could make it into weapons instead. I never, like, played it or got into it, but he seemed to think that that was, and the system itself seemed to be really adaptable. You could, you know, if you want Old West, you could, instead of it, you're throwing fireballs, you just adapt it into pistols or whatever. And I kind of thought that would be interesting to try to create a Star Trek one with the Hero system.
I'm sure you could do that. I don't have experience with that system personally.
Yeah, me too.
But there's a bunch of kind of generic systems out there, like GURPS or D6 Space, which has the advantage of being free.
Mm-hmm.
But those are ones I have less experience with. I just really like Mouse Guard, and it amuses me that you can use Mouse Guard to play Star Trek. Which I'm going to do one of these days, I promise.
Oh, you could do Mouse Trek. It would be adorable.
I
really enjoy how a lot of the combat mechanics work, which is that they're very broad, I feel. Mm-hmm. and lend themselves definitely to, I think, a lot of group play interaction and be able to accomplish different tasks and not get bogged down with a lot of math. I mean, there's still some math involved with it, but the numbers you're watching out for aren't like in like any like health points for your individual character. There's health associated with your character, but that's kind of resolved at the end of the conflict. But instead, there's a disposition number that's associated with each side of the conflict, and then you conduct your various actions, and allows you as a player and the GM to weave a better story than you would with other systems like D20, for example, which a lot of things are better than D20, where you're literally rolling dice and there's a lot of math involved with just making numbers go down. Whereas with Mouse Guard, you're actually giving a lot more context to what your actions are. You're having to describe a little more in detail what you're doing so that makes sense and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, and if we're going to get a little bit more into the sort of the numbers of it. One of the problems with Star Trek is, as a role-playing game, is that phasers are pretty much one-shot weapons. As far as how if you hit someone with a phaser, they really should be down for the count, unless they're some kind of weird alien who's resistant to phasers for some reason.
I was down for the count.
It's true. I did shoot you with a phaser, as I recall.
I didn't live to tell the tale.
So that if you have your traditional, you know, role-playing game combat where it's like, you know, point at that guy with your phaser, roll to hit him with the phaser, the combats are really short and really brutal, unless, you know, you're being very polite and using the stun settings. It's very hard, you know.
Use stun settings. It's only polite.
It is. I mean, it's the only way your players will survive a firefight, because, you know, I had this problem when I was running the game with the Last Unicorn system, because a phaser, even in, like, one of the mid-levels where you're not using, like, your entire charge on one shot, it does so much damage that just one lucky roll by the bad guy and suddenly one of your characters is dead.
Uh-oh.
Which
and
is not
like cover is any help, because, max setting, 600 cubic meters of rock instantly pulverized, I think. It's max
yep.
set on a phaser. Yeah. So, yeah. And, when I ran the Decipher game, it was the same sort of problem. You know, the mid-level settings, they don't even say damage after a while, it just says kill. So, but, you know, of course, you know, the higher level settings, they use more energy, and you have, like, you know, a limited capacitor in each phaser. So, the players in my game were doing two different things. First, bringing multiple phasers down, and just, like, you know, discarding the one that they used up, you know. Or, like, okay, no, then I started imposing bulk limits, you know. It's like, okay, you can't carry all this stuff down on an away mission. All right, so they set it on stun and started stunning people, and then just, like, either tying them up, or when it got really desperate, they just started, like, knifing them when they were down. It's like, oh, that's great. That's nice. Really in line with the Federation's philosophy on, you know, whatever.
You start to see some of the problems with some of these plots in Star Trek. Like, if you give your characters a tool that is capable of blowing away 600 cubic meters of rock, it's like, I had a story once where my players wanted to free some people from a Cardassian prison. And I was like, all right, so there's all these force fields at the entrance to the prison, and you're going to have to, like, either get the codes or talk your way past the guards. And they're like, well, why don't we just beam down outside the transporter denial field and use our phasers to blow a 600-meter hole in the wall? And I was like, ah.
Because we can!
And it's like, yeah, it's so that's one of the reasons why I appreciate the Mouse Guard conflict resolution system, is that it's not like I aim to shoot that guy. It's like I have an objective, and my objective is to get to the hostages and transport them to safety. And so now I'm going to make some rolls to see if I achieve that objective. So it's much more narrative, which I think works really well for a Star Trek game. Especially, and you know, when you're playing a Star Trek game that's more literal, you start to realize why everyone on Star Trek is such terrible shots. You know, that's sort of a thing Star Trek is known for, right? Is you have, like, the red shirts who just cannot hit anything. They're not, maybe not as bad as stormtroopers, but
They're really good at hitting really skinny railings that other characters are hiding behind.
That's true. Or, like, you got those like, Wonder Woman gauntlets that those aliens in that one episode of Deep Space Nine had. It was the one with Tosk. And it was just like,
oh, God, Tosk.
Yeah.
I love those gauntlets. I was like, why don't we see those more often?
Of course they're missing. I mean, okay, first, just look at the weapons themselves. The hand phasers don't have any sights on them.
Yeah.
You know, and their stance is all wrong. You know, you should be holding that with two hands in front of your face so you can kind of line it up with what you're shooting at. No, just, you know, just this wide angle stance and hold the phaser out generally in front of you and shoot dramatically. You're not going to hit anything like that. Not like Starfleet officers spend a whole lot of time, you know, practicing their firearms, you know, or anything like that. They don't expect to be able to use them.
I actually kind of one time played around and almost tested that, not, you know, scientifically, but I grabbed a laser pointer and I pretended it was a phaser, and I picked a picture or a thing on the wall, and I'm like, I got to shoot that quick, and I hit the laser pointer like the way they do on Star Trek. You know, not a proper stance for shooting. I was way off, so you kind of have to do sweeping movements
and
with it.
No wonder the Jem'Hadar had this all figured out. Jem'Hadar had iron sights on their weapons, and the Federation didn't.
Well, of course, you know, the phaser rifles are a step in the right direction. They actually have some, you know, rudimentary sights on there, you know. So
that's why we have rifles, is so we can have sights, Orin.
Yeah. Huge upgrade. Technology advances, you know. That's just...
Well, in Star Trek Enterprise, they brought on a team of, like, super advanced Marines, and one of their pieces of advanced technology was a scope. It was like we can shoot things that are far away. Although one thing that I find funny is, you guys talk about wide angles. There's one episode of Voyager which has made GMing Star Trek really difficult as far as phasers go, which is that they established this thing called the Y-beam setting, which is a way for Tuvok to stun the entire bridge with one phaser shot. And I'm just like, guys,
didn't,
why would
didn't
you...
Didn't they have that in the TOS? And then,
yeah,
Did they?
Yeah, when they're down on I thought Scary they had Party that. Planet, they use it.
I forgot about that. Well,
remember Scary
and then remember
Party
on...
Planet?
On Deep Space Nine, when they were always sweeping for the changelings, they would have their phasers or their rifles, and it would come out like a big, you know, cone or a big thing to cover the whole room.
Well, yeah, like that, that fan, kind of like thing. That basically that phaser ball that they had, like that thing was wider than a beam, but it still wasn't like an entire room. It could be that they established this in TOS, and I just forgot. That's probably what happened. I can't
say phaser ball, and I go back to the TAS, the animated series episode, where the thing take over the ship, and the first thing Kirk does is arm the defensive phaser.
And it's just this disco ball that shoots phasers. They brought
that's an excellent thing to have.
I guess that would cause some real panic at the disco. No, I can't leave. I'm on the airwaves. You
true.
Can't get rid of me.
And they brought
you
it back.
Stop.
They brought it back in Deep Space Nine, and you know what I think is a fairly good episode when the old like the security measures just prevent like Bajoran rioting kick in.
Yeah.
And there's like basically this big old phaser ball that just comes out of the replicator and starts trying to shoot them all. You know that thing is really handy. I wonder why they never used it after this. Like, you know, all the times when they got Klingons or Jem'Hadar trying to board the station is like, hey, fight the replicator, why don't you?
Arm the replicators.
So that's actually stepping away from phasers, but in the same area. That's another kind of problem with running a Star Trek role-playing game. And I'm interested to hear how you try to handle this, Damon, is sometimes the technology that they have in Star Trek, if you really sit and think about it, has potential uses way beyond anything they ever actually do with it in the show. And that can make it kind of hard to tell a good story. So, you know, did you ever run into that problem?
Yeah, that's kind of an issue, you know, especially the replicators. When you can just have anything you need for any mission ever, you know, how do you deny that ability to the players and still keep a challenge level? You know, it's the way I dealt with it. I think the excuse was, okay, well, no, I'm not going to give you some random replicator malfunction every single time, but the replicator uses like substrate. You know, it's a matter that's just kind of sitting there, and you have a limited amount on it because you've got a tiny little frigate, you know, on a galaxy class on, you know, and so they have to kind of manage their resources. What do they want to replicate? Like, okay, we're just going to build an M1A1 tank piece by piece and just be
like,
you
know, like you that, do. Like
yeah,
you.
You know, so no, that's just not going to be feasible. And the other thing, I made it more about the player's skills. Okay, yeah, you can, you know, replicate whatever fancy gear you want, but do you know how to use it? You know, that's...
You failed to use Keycup.
T. Earl Grey is now all over the front of your uniform.
And it is still very hot, let me tell you. See, I wasn't even ready to put that much effort into my solution. I just said it before replicators. I was just like, I can't deal with replicators. You guys are... replicators don't exist yet, all right? You guys are set in the past in, like, the Enterprise C era. They don't know what a replicator is.
I honestly had more trouble dealing with the sensors they have, especially in the 24th century. You know, they're near omniscient. You can see, like, microscopic life forms on the surface of a planet from your starship, you know? So if you're looking for something that's hidden, that gives you a huge advantage.
Yeah, just a little. And they basically have, you know, tricorders, which are sometimes, you know, are almost, sometimes they're almost as accurate as, like, the starship sensors, just in a smaller box. And, you know, so that can be a little bit of a problem, too. It's like, hey, one of your friends has gone missing. Go down and look for him. Like, well, I'm just going to get on this tricorder. And, okay, there he is.
Green dot over there.
Yeah. Although, Damon, I actually used the same solution as you partly. I put my players on a very small, little, you know, patrol ship, basically. which was Bob's suggestion, actually. I was originally going to put them on an Oberth class, which is that space canoe we saw in Star Trek 3. And Bob was like, I don't want any of that.
How do you even get from the engineering section to the lab section on that ship?
You take a spacewalk, okay? But Bob showed me this little Okinawa class patrol ship that I think was from one of the Starfleet Battles games?
Starfleet Command 2.
Yeah. So I had my player, it was this tiny little ship. It had a staircase.
It was so rad. We had a staircase in our ship.
It was only five decks.
That was a big selling point for you, I guess.
I was stoked. I was like, yeah, a staircase. Well, because the thing is that, I shared a lot of...
Wait. It's not even an escalator. You can't just stand on it and have it take you up.
But those are dangerous.
The famous words of Mitch Hedberg, sorry for the convenience.
Yeah. Escalator temporarily stairs.
Sorry for the convenience. Yeah. I kind of share a lot of Oren's, and I guess Damon's too, fears about, Star Trek, role-playing games and a lot of the technology that's available. Which is why I volunteered to be the chief engineer on the ship and not the captain, because I knew I could technobabble realistic solutions to stuff that would still be in contextual stories, narratives and stuff, and not break stuff. That
you did a fine job.
What's that?
You did a fine job, which is why I killed you.
Competence is rewarded with death. Right? So that's why I suggested, I recall you wanted to do a smaller vessel so we didn't have a really powerful ambassador class or anything, which was the mainline ship at the time, available for us. And I had kind of pitched that out there as the Okinawa because it was a really small kind of police patrol frigate. And that kind of jived with the idea that you had. So
it worked out great. I also didn't want you to have an army of red shirts at your disposal. I learned that lesson. I tried to run a very short-lived Star Trek game a while back where I gave my players a larger ship, and they just solved everything by Zerg rushing it with red shirts.
All you got's a hammer.
Yeah, when all you have is an army of red shirts with 600-meter exploding phasers, it's suddenly everything looks like it needs to be exploded with red shirts.
Okay, and also, speaking of phasers and Zerg rushes, we gotta deal with the elephant in the room.
Yeah?
Mm. Orbital strikes. If players can do it, they will. They will at every opportunity. Can this be solved with a giant beam from space? Maybe? Well, that sounds like a yes to me. No? Well, that sounds like a maybe.
Really, what do we have to lose by trying, right? Okay, so the way that I dealt with that was suddenly every planet they wanted to go to had very strong, orbital shields.
You're in an underground cavern a mile below the surface again, coincidentally.
Did we ever try to do an orbital strike of some sort? I don't remember.
In serious mode, the way that I dealt with that, again, this is my second Star Trek game. My first Star Trek game, I didn't have a plan. And in fact, as David pointed out, my players did solve a number of problems with orbital strikes. in some cases, that was actually fine. There were some stories where I had that as a legitimate option for how to solve a problem, but it gets a little boring if that's your solution every time, right? So what I did in the second game was that I basically, I reminded you guys that an orbital bombardment is not precise. And since most of the adventures that I had you guys going on were in populated areas, and you guys were interested enough in being Starfleet officers that you weren't just going to throw away the morality of it at the slightest chance. So it was, there wasn't really an opportunity to use them because it was sure, we could send down a photon torpedo and kill the bad guy, but we would also kill 5 million people around him. Or, even if we were using phasers, which are more precise, it would be a significant amount of collateral damage. Now, fortunately, none of my players had seen the TOS episode, except for maybe Bob, and he was being nice, where they established you can set the ship's phasers to stun.
No. I did bring that up. That was the thing we had discussed.
So I just hand-waved that and pretended that it didn't happen. That was a fever dream that Kirk had. He wished he could do that.
He just woke up in the middle of the night and was like, Bones, I had the best dream!
It was like, if only we could just stun the entire planet!
I've got this crazy idea.
you know, also a lot of the adventures take place on other ships or are, you know, about ship-to-ship combat, which I generally didn't spend too much time dwelling on because the ship-to-ship combat system in those games is less than robust. Mm-hmm. So I basically just had them, I had the players, I was like, hey, this is going to be resolved by your captain making a command roll, and everyone else is going to make a roll to either help or hinder. It's like, can you do your job well? You give your captain a bonus. If not, you give him a penalty because you messed
Man,
it up.
Man, our poor little Miranda class got the crap kicked out of it at the end.
Your Okinawa class, yeah, it did. You guys had to
the Okinawa was straight up destroyed, right?
Yes.
I mean, that was what I was expecting from the get-go, because that thing was, like, you know, freaking flying tin can jalopy. You know, I was expecting that at some point. The Miranda, though, I was kind of expecting it to put up a little more of a fight than it did.
I think the Miranda survived. I'm trying to remember how that all went.
Well, it did survive. That's because I had my last-ditch little, like, shield modulation technobabble thing that I did.
It's true. I'm trying to remember what you guys were actually fighting, but I don't... I remember there was, like, some kind of ancient, like, evil space alien, but... I did get something of a kick of blowing up your ships whenever I could. Now, another sort of issue, this one is not related to technology at all, this is more of a social problem, is how do you determine who's the captain? Because assumedly someone is going to be the captain, right?
Yeah, I think there's two ways of dealing with it mainly. First, you either let the players decide. You know, if you just pick the captain arbitrarily, okay, this player is the teacher's pet and he's the captain now and you all have to follow him and do what he says, then they're going to resent that player.
Yeah.
So either let them discuss and decide themselves, you know, if they want to choose their different roles, or you could make each player a captain. They each have their own ship, their own responsibilities, Ooh. And they have to work together for one reason or another. If you want them on the same ship, you can do the Voyager route. Oh, well, this ship got destroyed, so you all got to bunk in the same ship, you know, and it won't eliminate the problem, but it'll at least mitigate it a little bit and create kind of an interesting tension and social dynamic on board that ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought of doing that. What I ended up doing, my solution was that, well, A, sometimes I just have a player who everyone, you know, likes doing what they say, and mm-hmm. I didn't have one of those this time around. I think Bob was probably the closest, but he wanted to be the chief engineer, which is a good choice. So what I did was I talked to the players and we all kind of agreed on who was going to be the captain. And just to make sure that player didn't like go mad with power, I had the
There's always one.
Yeah, I mean, it does happen, right? Is you put a player in a position of authority over the other players, and it's not unlikely that they will at some point, not because they're bad people, but just because of the social dynamics, try to abuse that power.
Mm-hmm. And there've been scientific experiments about that. Yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So what
you just put it into action through, you know, games.
So what I did was I made the first officer an NPC, and that way, if the captain was ever being too, like, you know, giving crazy orders and just, like, you know, telling people to do stuff just because he could, I could have the first officer step in and be like, hey, captain, you need to calm down.
Everyone hated that first officer.
Everyone loved that first officer. You shut your mouth.
But not, I've made it with a woman.
Alert the men.
But the dual role that first officer played was that if the players ever started going, you're not my real dad, and on the captain, and refused, you know, which is another thing that happens sometimes, right? Is that sometimes the players will rebel against perfectly, you know, reasonable orders that the captain gives just because they can. And so then I have this NPC available because for some reason players just have an easier time following commands when they come from the GM as opposed to another player. Not everybody, obviously. It's not universal, but that way, you know, I had this NPC who I could step in to support the captain if a player was doing that, which I didn't have to do very often, I was glad to say, but it did happen sometimes. And another sort of question that's sort of on that same line is, so, you know, the traditional Star Trek, TOS story is we see a problem and we send down Kirk, Spock and McCoy.
And a red shirt.
What if your players want a slightly more realistic story, right? And if they're all the senior staff, you're probably not going to send the senior staff down to investigate some kind of odd problem on a planet, right?
I think we should send all the captains from all the starships in orbit as the away team.
What was that, Grace? I'm sorry.
If you just send Sulu and some other guy down, they'll both go crazy and you'll have to come in and bail them out.
That's true. Or they might freeze to death. I think that was another thing that happened when Sulu was in charge of an away mission. And
or Sulu, not so great with away missions.
You could go the Starfleet Online route where you beam down like five different captains and have them all try to sort the problem out.
Yeah.
With guns.
Lots of guns.
Justice guns.
Stupid amounts of ordnance are carried by people that are in Star Trek Online.
Oh, yeah.
Although you still don't have purple space bazookas. Apparently that's an animation problem.
No, but I do have a gun that shoots snowballs now.
Oh, man. What else do you need?
We have energy whips.
Yeah, that is pretty cool, I gotta admit.
But in all seriousness, Damon, did you ever run into this problem where you were like, you know, it's like, I have a story I want to tell, but really there's no reason for the players to be the ones to go investigate. Realistically, they would send subordinates to do it.
Let's see. At one point I did the ham-fisted route of the vastly superior alien intelligence demands that these specific people who represent your species in their best capacity will beam down. You know, that sort of thing.
Send us your leaders!
Yeah. Another way, yeah, the crew wanted to beam down red shirts to solve the problem, and they disappeared mysteriously. And they did it again. Okay, they also never heard back from them. Okay, we gotta go down ourselves.
Did they send down two sets of red shirts?
Double red shirt.
Keep throwing red shirts.
Sir, team one's reporting out. All right, send in team two to find team one. Sir, team two's gone. Bullshit.
If you want something done right.
Pretty much.
Now, what I ended up doing was I actually had everyone create two characters, their senior staff character and then their sort of away mission character who was a lower ranked officer who was, you know, the kind of person that would be sent on a, you know, on a mission that seemed less important. And so the senior officers were really doing a lot of political intrigue, actually, and a lot of, you know, command level decisions. And then, you know, what is that funny, Bob? Are you mocking my game?
We won the rugby game. They lost the rugby.
Yes, there was a lot of rugby in that. I remember that was your guys' thing. You started a rugby match, yes.
Every session, we'd always start off with a rugby match, which was inspired by my character, because my character was a Cajun that played rugby, and everyone's like, yeah, let's play a rugby game! And then we played against Klingons, and I remember, like, I had, like, a negative health modifier, because I got shoulder chicken into a wall. And it sucked.
Wouldn't they?
They would be, and they were, it turned out. And that was sort of like the rugby match was sort of our game's version of the TNG poker table, right? It was, you know, it was just what you guys did to hang out and have fun together when you weren't, you know, shooting aliens or trying to keep your ship alive.
It would always be, no matter what happened, no matter what the outcome was, we'd always sing that stupid song. It'd be some variation of, like, we won the rugby game, they lost the rugby game, or something like that. Or if we tied, it'd be, you know, that instead of won or lost, so...
You guys won most
of
your
games.
To
the tune of Queens, We Are the Champions. Is that the thing that was going on there?
That was the thing I thought about, but it was myself and another player who kind of had carried that tune that we had.
there are no tunes carried here.
As I recall, you guys became friends.
Hold on, wait. I just realized we did get Bob singing this episode.
Oh, again!
God damn it.
Every friggin' time!
So,
but anyway, Orin, yeah, I do like that that idea of having multiple characters. The only conceivable problem I can think of is if those characters need to interact at any point in time. Yeah.
I did that. You do a lot of juggling is what you do. So
that called the characters were of different departments is how you did that, is that you have two characters. One's your senior officer character who is ahead of whatever department, and then your other secondary character is in a different department under someone else. So, like, I had my chief engineer character, but then I had, like, an ensign science character of some sort.
Yeah, so for the most part, the way I was able to handle it was there were a couple of instances in which the away team characters cross paths with the senior officer characters, but I was usually able to handle it where it's like, hey, you know, Bob, you're going to play your chief engineer, and then my brother and Kelsey are going to be playing their lower officer characters, and you guys are going to go on a mission together.
All right, you're going to be babysitting the scrubs.
Yeah, and the only time this was a little bit of a problem was that the guy playing the captain had his other character who was like a pilot with like a troubled past, and they were both great characters, but he had this idea that they were like that like the captain had like taken his ensign under his wing and was kind of like his mentor character, and it was just like, I'm sorry, that is never going to happen. Like, there is no conceivable way for this to work, because I can't roleplay your character for you, and you can't spend 10 minutes talking to yourself in the scene. So we just had to, you know, sort of drop that. But for the most part, it wasn't actually that big a problem. It was just a matter of having the second group of characters be people that wouldn't be routinely interacting with whoever the player's other character was. So I was pretty happy with the way that turned out. Now, this is a question for everybody, not just the three of us who have been playing a lot of Star Trek role-playing games, is what era do you think is best for a Star Trek RPG? And David, you haven't had a chance to say a whole lot. Do you have an opinion on this? And of course, this can be Klingon-related, too.
Days of Kalis. Days of Kalis.
Of course, it would be an all Klingon RPG. But it kind of depends, like what you guys were saying. If you're going to go, you know, if you're going to go like the next generation DS9 route, you're going to have a lot of tech. You're going to have a lot of, you know, that type of thing. So I kind of think to make it more interesting, it might be the TOS era, or like, you know, the TOS movie eras, because you're not going to have the tricorder that's just going to tell you everything you need to know, or, you know, all the gadgets and everything. So I think maybe that would be more, you know, fun to have to solve problems and figure things out. But in a way, if the system could be worked out, maybe, you know, it would be fun to do, like, you know, galaxy class ships fighting each other. That was another thing. It's like a lot of the role-playing games in general are, you know, people on the ground or doing stuff. Has there been a big either with you guys or a game out there that is total RPG, you know, rolling dice, but is about the ships instead? Or is it mostly always about the people? Because then, you know, I think that could be part of what influences an era. But
yeah,
I'd probably go with the TOS.
There was Starfleet Battles.
That is still around, believe it or not.
Yeah, yeah, it still exists. I loved Starfleet Command, you know, the PC versions of it.
Yeah!
I just hated dealing with the actual tabletop version, because it's, like, so many completely opaque and obtuse rules. It's just, it's not fun. It's not, you know, really playable. But yeah, there is some combat in the Decipher games. There's some ship combat. It's not handled incredibly well. I think the ideal way to do it would be to do kind of a tactical thing with like a hex grid and, you know, free movement and power management, things like that. But simplified enough that it doesn't take hours and hours and hours to resolve like a 5-second combat round.
Man, you could get a game of Starfleet Battles done in hours? That's like a 3-month proposal for me.
Well, we're talking at, you know, if like Noonian type, Soong type androids were, you know, doing all the calculations for us, you know, that'd be the ideal.
Now, Grace, you were saying something earlier. I think we ran over you. What was that?
Huh?
I thought you were, it sounded like you had something that you were about to comment on something. And
I heard her groan at the mention of some game or
another. Yeah, that was probably more like it.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
now,
I'm not nearly as experienced with role-playing games as you guys are, so I have a minimal amount of input in this conversation.
Well, that's what you get for living in Tacoma.
Although, again,
I'm not suffering enough by living here already.
I do think that I would like to know what your favorite era to roleplay in would be. Like, where do you think the best stories are to be had?
I don't know. TNG to Deep Space Nine era is just where most of my interest lies.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I just think that there's a bunch of different conflicts going on at once, so you'd have a lot to work with.
That's fair.
And yeah. Like, you could fight the Borg, you could be fighting the Dominion, the Cardassians. There's just a really wide variety to work with there.
I think the most important thing about which era it takes place in is the atmosphere and theme. You know, when you think TOS, you think like cowboy space adventure. You know, you know, TNG is more of a kind of a heavy-handed ethical dilemmas. you know, bizarre, unseen new life, and, you know, like, you know, that's the core of Star Trek right there. You know, DS9, mm-hmm. political intrigue and fighting the Dominion, huge space battles, and Voyager. Yeah.
Voyager's doing something, okay.
Voyager would have been a better role-playing game than an actual show, I think. You know, the premise is great. Your ship is stranded, you know, all these light years away from home, and yeah, what do you do?
Man, I was really disappointed that my friend never ran this game.
Bombard the nearest civilization to steal their tech.
Yeah, because like a friend of mine actually was going to run a game kind of like that. It was sort of like Voyager rebooted was sort of his idea. It was like instead of in this awesome long range exploration ship, what if you guys were in a like you know just a random patrol vessel that got grabbed? And basically, what if you guys were on the Equinox? And you know all the senior officers were killed, so you guys are playing like. Ensigns and lieutenants that have been elevated to command position, that sort of thing.
I like that idea.
Yeah, I did too. I was super excited about it, and then he never ran it. Because he's, you know,
I unsuccessfully barter with the K's on, and then they take my ship for its water capacities.
And so, David, to answer one of your questions, again, from way earlier back, talking about like ship battles, part of the problem with ship battles in a role-playing game is that if you could make a good tactical ship combat game, you would just package it as a board game, which is what some people have already done. So the ship combat systems in role-playing games tend to be pretty, like, you know, they were kind of thrown in there as an afterthought more than anything else.
A possibility. If you can play the main, you know, like whatever system you want for the actual role-playing game, when it comes to ship combat, you take one of those board games and use that.
Yeah, I honestly don't think that's a bad idea there. At the moment, we're a little bit starved for Star Trek board games, but I'm sure that there, you know, will be more out eventually. You could play it using Star Trek Attack Wing and have the Enterprise mad OP power to go backwards.
Sir, they use reverse thrust. What? Impossible.
How they do? I mean,
how happened? How does happen?
Impossible.
What was that ship game that just came out recently? I think you guys even played it and talked about it, like Fleet Captain, or what? Remember that?
Well, Fleet Captain is its own very odd board game, which I have my own problems with. But it's really more of like a giant like Star Trek episode simulator. It's like you're flying through space and just constantly being hit by random spatial anomalies. But the game that came out more recently than that, even with what we were just talking about, was Star Trek Attack Wing. In which the Enterprise is just mad OP. Like me and my friend Jim were playing it, and he played better than me at every turn, no question. But I won because I was in the Enterprise with Captain Picard, and there was just he could not stop me because I could go backwards and I'd get behind him and I could shoot in any direction, and he was in his Klingon ship trying to fight me, and it was just not happening. Game balance, I guess, was more of a suggestion when they were making those rules than an actual requirement.
More like a guideline.
Now, here's another question that I've always struggled with is, do you ever have your RPG characters meet the canon characters from the show?
I feel a little uncomfortable, you know, trying to portray these established, beloved characters in a game, you know. You know, at, like, the most interaction they'll get, maybe, like, a long-range subspace communication, you know, from... Mm-hmm. So-and-so. It's like, oh, that's a nice nod to canon continuity. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, oh, now you have to go save Geordi LaForge. I don't know. I don't feel good about it.
Yeah, it's kind of awkward. It's like, you know, like these characters have such an established personality already that it's like, you're just imitating them.
Mm-hmm. Well, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
That is true.
I can tell you, as a player, I would not want to interact with canon characters in any way, shape, or form.
Why's that?
Just because it diminishes my experience as a player in playing as a Starfleet officer in this, you know, universe, right? So the idea is that, you know, with this game is that we're very much having our own adventure. We are doing our own Starfleet, or whatever, you know, empire you choose to portray in the game. We're having our own experience, and we're having our own unique adventures. Now, we've all seen the TV shows, and we all know a lot of the really, you know, awesome, crazy situations that those guys have been in, right? And, you know, seeing that, it very much feels like the politics and the, you know, intrigue and everything else that goes along with those universes revolves around those 6, 7, or 8 characters that are in the main cast, right? So if you start introducing those characters into the game, it really feels like, you know, like I don't really have any bearing on this universe here that's you know going on around me. I just feel like I'm very ancillary to what's going on here. My role is diminished as a player, I feel.
hey, Captain Kirk has saved the galaxy 3 times, and he just got up this morning. How about you? It's like, well, we tried to send red shirts down to the planet to see our problem.
No, I completely agree, Bob. I think that introducing like these really larger-than-life characters into your story is a really great way to make your players feel unimportant.
It turns them into side characters in their own story, essentially.
And then sometimes they get mad and they want to punch Sisko. This is a thing that happens, all right? I don't want to talk about it.
Not even going to ask.
In Soviet Continuum, Sisko punches Q.
No, that happened.
Remember that the Federation is a socialist utopia, so that basically is Soviet continuity right there.
What is happening?
Well, because, yeah, according to the brilliant philosophers on board Earth Space Dock in Star Trek Online, communism equals socialism. There's no gray area between those. And so, yep. You must be right.
I don't know
what game they're playing, I guess.
What, are you guys talking about, like, NPCs in Star Trek Online?
No, I wish they were NPCs, because then maybe we could kill them or delete them.
What is he talking about?
Talking about ESD general chat.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It's terrible.
All right, that's fair. All right. So, Grace, I know you have to go in a minute here or so. We are getting close to the end of things I wanted to talk about, but if you have to duck out, you got to move. There's basically two more questions I have on my list. One, the first one that we'll talk about briefly is, do you guys think there's any like potential for a game in a Star Trek universe that is not about Starfleet characters?
Why not?
Like, you know, is that so Grace, is that something you'd be interested in playing?
Definitely. I mean, we already, albeit jokingly, talked about all Klingon game, and mm-hmm. it would definitely be interesting to see when we've got such a wide expanse of different characters and societies and cultures to play around with. It'd be pretty foolish not to take advantage of that when there's so much to do.
David, what about you?
Yeah, I think, a Klingon campaign would be very interesting. It would require the players to know a significant amount about, like, Klingon culture and history and stuff like that.
Or just have them be the generic space Vikings.
Yeah, generic space Vikings, right. Viking samurai kind of honor and glory. But yeah, some of the other races would be a little difficult, like an all Vulcan. That'd get a little dry.
Slow, yeah. Unless you're like really into political intrigue and stuff.
Oh, how about all Borg?
Dude, we have to do that now.
Only if I get to keep a journal.
Oh dear.
I repaired Muna Matrix 1145 today. It was a good.
Oh, see, you can't even write a journal because there is no I. You can't write I in a Borg journal.
We repaired Muna Matrix 1145 today. It was a good
time
day.
To regenerate.
Time to regenerate.
Borg are really, it's really confusing to read a Borg journal because they always use we as their pronoun. It's, you know, and then I asked we out, and we said yes, and we had a good time, and it's like, what are they talking about?
Turns out Borg has a crush on you.
And what I was actually kind of originally thinking was, like, not even necessarily everyone's part of the same race, but, like, just, like, a civilian ship. Like, you know, Star Trek Firefly, you know, as a, for lack of a better comparison.
Here's the thing about a civilian. Okay, so you have an interstellar vessel. In Star Trek, they're powered by antimatter. You don't leave civilians in charge of something like that, generally. Because, you know, I think it was Larry Niven who said the more interesting a space drive is, the better it can be used as a weapon. I'm kind of paraphrasing that.
Yeah.
You just take your, your warp-capable antimatter-powered vessel and, you know, threaten to slam it into a planet if you don't get your way, because if without strict military training and discipline, that's probably what a player would do at least once.
Yeah, probably. Or you know, maybe they might go and take control of that that basically giant space gun that fires warp waves that they had in what's the episode of TNG where they have that? It's one of the Alexander episodes.
One of them.
Proving ground, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Just we've had long discussions about why they don't use that as a weapon. It's kind of like, you know, that this is a thing that apparently can cause serious damage to planets from basically as far away as another planet. It's, you know, sort of what that's not something you could ever let PCs get their hands on. All right, so there's really only one other thing that I wanted to mention, which just go around those of us who are left because Grace had to leave. What would be your ultimate Star Trek campaign? And David, I know the answer is going to involve Klingons.
Well, I mean, definitely, if you're going to go the Klingon route, you could do like a house versus house rivalry, or you could reenact one of the great wars. But to me, because I played D&D a long time ago, like back in the 80s, and I'm trying to think back to some of the, you know, we did every now and then just do like all combat, you know, rush the castle and destroy, kill, and all that. Those are kind of fun, but even if it is Klingon or another race, I think a campaign that I would enjoy would have some combat, you know, but also have like problems to solve or, you know, something you have to kind of overcome, whether it's, you know, saving hostages or, I don't know, it could play out in different ways, but I wouldn't want just all combat, even if it is a mm-hmm. Klingon thing. And so something where, you know, the players have to kind of figure out among themselves what's the best strategy or the best tactic to use, and, you know, not everybody might agree of the best way to get it done, but, you know, something like that. And I think that could also really go into the Star Trek, you know, mentality of not just, you know, kill everything and just, you know, destroy and break down walls. And so, I don't know, it'd be difficult to balance it out, but something that had, you know, some, back when we did D&D, one of the GM had a good, a way to add comedy to things. And so that was, you know, that could be tricky to figure it out, how to add that all the time. But that would be another thing, something that, you know, makes everybody laugh and, you know, have some element of humor or comedy into the campaign, but also combat and strategy type stuff. So a diversified type of campaign.
I think an all Klingon game would be very great potential for comedy because, you know, all you see in the show is like rough Klingon warriors, but there's going to be other professions, right, among the mm-hmm. Klingons, like a Klingon programmer. Debug? Klingons do not debug. Our software does not coddle the weak. You know, you have stuff like that, you know. Like, Klingon doctor, you walk in, doctor, my leg is broken, just walk it off.
I require that soundbite.
I'll see what I can do for you.
Decoding Klingons, I require.
Or like, you know, you have the idea of the Klingon version of those various TNG stories where it's like, a captain, an alien probe is coming and scanning us, and it's like, well, destroy it! No yeah, credits.
Exactly. A giant energy cloud. Shoot torpedoes.
I want to see that. Okay, like, okay, here's the pilot of the new show, Star Trek Klingon Empire, okay? Hey, intro. They encounter a mysterious alien probe. You know, credits. You know, it's like 1.5 minutes for credits. Counters mysterious alien probe. Fire photon torpedoes, and the probe is destroyed. End credits roll. That's it.
All right. So, Bob, what would be your idea of an ultimate Star Trek campaign?
Ultimate Star Trek campaign. Wow.
What would you really like to play in for a Star Trek game?
Well, I would probably want. What I would want is at some point in the late 23rd, very early 24th century, on board, you know, probably either an Ambassador or an Excelsior.
It's always the Excelsior class with you, isn't it?
I'm a big fan of the Excelsior. And do a tour of duty similar to what was in TNG. Kind of. I mean, you can kind of sort of chart a path of where the USS Enterprise was at in TNG, you know, and,
right.
and have kind of conduct that same sort of patrol path and encounter those situations as you rolled.
Interesting. So sort of a like just see what's out there kind of story.
Yeah. And really, you know, because TNG characters really grew over their, you know, 7 seasons. They were very different characters by the end of the 7 years. Right. So I would definitely love to launch into it with, you know, either a fresh character just at the academy or a character that's just come off another ship and has assumed the responsibilities as a department head or something like that, or they became a department head as the ship plotted along, and then they grow and their characters develop even more based on all the circumstances and situations that they run into and such. So
yeah, it does sound like fun.
It's a very, very broad answer, I know, but it's that's really it, is that I would like to have a Star Trek TV show, but, you know, earlier in time. You know, kind of that lost era that we have there, right? Because we don't really know what's going on before 2363 and after 2292, I think, which is when the Enterprise B gets beat up by the Nexus.
Yeah, gotta get beat up by the Nexus.
So, I mean, there's like a good 50 years in there where we just have, like, nothing other than, hey, the Enterprise C was built, the Cardassians were kind of some jerks, and the Romulans did a thing. That's kind of all we got.
They did an entire thing. Now, since I want to end by asking Damon, my idea, what I was thinking of, that I think would be really fun, is I want to play the events that led up to the signing of the Treaty of Algeron, because I want to know what the heck happened. Because it's like, somehow the Federation ended up signing this treaty that made it so that they wouldn't develop cloaking technology. It's like, well, you know, what is Algeron? Like, what happened there that was so important to make this treaty a thing? You know, like, I've always wanted to know that story. And yeah, so that's, I would hear
more about the Federation Romulan War, you know?
Yeah.
That would,
and so is that your idea for a campaign, Damon?
No, that was kind of a tertiary idea.
That would be really
idea.
Boring, flying around.
Yeah, and yeah, I have the same ideas, Warren. Good night, everybody. But yeah, but no, I had several ideas. One of them would be probably late TNG era, deep space exploration ship, like way, way out there on the frontier, like, you know, months away from any support or help. So the players are really isolated, and they stumble across an alien life form that is just unfathomably alien. That's kind of the kind of show I like. You know, they're the first contact, just coincidentally because they happen to be there, and the crew has to deal with it.
He wants to play Riker Destroyer of Worlds game.
For reference, David, that is a reference to the Star Trek Titan books, in which Riker is in command of his own ship, and he will show up at a place, and because of something he either directly or indirectly did, terrible catastrophes will occur.
Huh. That sounds interesting.
That's apparently what happens when you make Riker a captain.
Well, because they encounter things that are so alien, they just don't know how to deal with them, and then they do deal with it, it turns out that they weren't supposed to deal with it at all, and there was no problem, and they created a problem.
Well, you know, just got to figure. It's either them or us, you know. But the other idea I had, so imagine, if you will, there's a, you know, a gigantic alien mechanism. You're not even sure if it's inhabited. Comes directly to Earth.
It's playing dubstep.
Yeah. Yeah, it might have dubstep. That'd be even worse, though. And it just kind of plows its way through all of your defenses and starts boiling the oceans on Earth. What are you going to do, you know, and then it just leaves because it talks to some whales. What are you going to do? What if it comes back and there is no more whales and you can't time travel because the GM has, like, an insane hatred of time travel and thinks it ruins everything except for Back to the Future and Chrono Trigger? You know, what do you do? You're going to have to take out that whale probe at some point. You know, it's a threat. It's a threat to all civilizations with an ocean on their planet. So I think that would be an interesting, you know, kind of thing. That's just kind of left dangling, you know. It's these aliens are either incredibly stupid or, you know, incredibly genocidal, or they don't even recognize human beings as, like, a life form, which is just as bad. So
it's kind of odd considering that we built spaceships, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, we've got spaceships, they've got spaceships. You figure we could connect on that level.
So, yeah, there's something up with that. You know, I think it would be interesting to at least explore what that probe was, where it came from, what its motivations are.
I vaporized the probe 600 cubic meters at a time.
All right, everybody. Well, Damon, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And it was good to have you back, Bob.
We won the rugby game. They lost the rugby game.
Oh, dear. All right, so I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. There was something I wanted to read from the chat real quick here, because I thought it was a particularly brilliant piece of insight. This is from Mr. Slightly Off Redshirt, and it says, simple way to solve all tech issues with the Star Trek RPG story begins. You have just crash-landed on a pre-industrial planet as your... You've just crash-landed on a pre-industrial planet as you exit your shuttle wreck... Which I think was a pretty... I think that's a pretty good solution to all of our problems.
I scared the natives with fire. Bend them to my will with my firebox.
All right. Well, I hope you guys will join us next week when we speak with Data Logan. And if you're listening to the podcast version of this, you're about to hear his commentary on our last couple of episodes. David, if you would not mind playing us off with some music.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's Datalog.
One is my name. The other is not.
2014, January 18. I really liked the podcast you guys did on Gene Roddenberry's Vision. I think it really hit on a lot of salient points. I don't have much to add there. One little thing I can mention, not about the main topic of that episode, but something you guys mentioned in passing. You talked about the episode Ensign Ro, when Ro Laren comes aboard the Enterprise, and Riker tells her, you will follow Starfleet uniform code aboard this ship. And supposedly that means she can't wear an earring, and you question that. Well, why can't she wear an earring? I mean, Worf wears a balderdash and that kind of stuff. It seems like Starfleet uniform code would allow for some cultural or religious differences, right? So I have my own little theory about that. Have you noticed that Ro Laren wears her earring on the wrong side, right? She's one of the few people that we see who wears her earring on her left ear. And all other Bajorans, or almost all other Bajorans, wear their earring on the right ear. The right ear is the appropriate ear to wear it on, culturally and religiously, because the left ear is the ear that you present to the Vedics, and they come in with their right hand, and they pinch your left ear to test your pa. The idea behind the Ro character is that she sort of shuns a lot of Bajoran society and isn't religious, but still has some connections with the Bajoran people. So she chose to wear a Bajoran earring, but she wears it on the left side instead of the right side. We do see other people much later on in Deep Space Nine, the Pah Wraith cult wore their earring on the left side, for similar yet more extremist reasons why they wanted to be separated from the normal Bajoran culture and religion. So here's my theory about the whole Starfleet uniform code thing, right? Maybe the uniform code is written such that it's okay for a Bajoran to wear an earring on their right ear, because that is the normal cultural thing. And so if you have a Bajoran who's coming on board like Ro Laren, and she's wearing it on her left ear, technically that's not a cultural thing, right? That's not part of your culture. You're obviously doing something different. An analogy would be, you guys talked about some of the Native American Indian people who we saw in Star Trek The Motion Picture, who wore feathers in their hair. So maybe Starfleet regs would say, hey, if your culture includes feather braiding in your hair, that's okay. But you wouldn't necessarily be able to braid anything in your hair. Just because you happen to be descended from Native Americans doesn't mean you can take a bit of plastic and braid it into your hair, and that's okay. So what I'm suggesting is that the uniform code would have defined cultural things that are okay, but a Bajoran wearing an earring on the left ear is not an okay thing. But then again, in order for that to work as an explanation, then that would presuppose that Riker knew enough about the regulations that he noticed the earring was on the wrong ear, and he said that to make her take it off. And it seems pretty obvious in the episode that Riker doesn't know much about Bajoran culture, because he gets Ro Laren's name wrong. He calls her Ensign Laren initially, thinking that Laren was her family name. And if the Starfleet uniform code is written this way, it does really call into question, what does it take to have a culture? You know, I mean, I mentioned the Pah Wraith cults wear their earring on their left ear. Isn't that an acceptable form of culture and religion? Couldn't Ro Laren say, it's okay, I wear it over here, not necessarily because I am part of a Pah Wraith cult, but it's an allowable variation in the Bajoran religion? Remember, Picard once said to Data that a culture of one is enough. So it really doesn't make sense to think that the Starfleet uniform code would be so discerning. If you want to wear anything different with the Starfleet uniform, you have to have at least 100,000 people in your culture agree with you. Doesn't make sense. One thing I especially liked in that episode about Roddenberry's vision was when David talked about the Idic, or the idea of, let's celebrate our differences and talk about our differences and not just tolerate each other. It's always been something I've strived for my own self and my own life, my own personal philosophy, and that I thought was maybe missing from some of the bad episodes of Star Trek. You know, like the first or second season of TNG, for instance. The whole discussion reminds me of a comment I made to you guys in a previous datalog of mine about 6 months ago, where I talked about the Idic and how I wished it would have been a human idea instead of a Vulcan idea. Here's a little excerpt from that. I never really thought the Idic was a very Vulcan idea. Infinite diversity and infinite combinations is not something that the Vulcans seem really good at. They just never really seem like a race that was striving for diversity or striving to be open to different ideas. They actually seem very close-minded in a lot of ways. The Idic only appeared in one episode of the original series, Is There in Truth No Beauty? And they have this woman on board, Miranda Jones, and they have this dinner scene where she's talking to Spock about the Idic pin that he's wearing on his chest and what it means. I always thought it would have been interesting, instead of Spock wearing the Idic and having this conversation with Miranda Jones, what if it was Bones that was doing that? You know, what if Dr. McCoy was showing off a bit of human philosophy, something that had been developed in the future, and then it was presented as that, something the humans had come to realize once they got out into the galaxy and they started meeting all these different, diverse alien races, and something the humans had created and the humans had embraced, and it was because of humanity that all these other races had merged together and formed the Federation. I think we did see that in Star Trek Enterprise, the idea that humanity was the one who was able to go out and talk to these different races and bring these different races to the table together to form the Federation. So I think it would have been nice if they had linked that in with the Idic somehow. Plus, the other benefit of that idea is that you actually acknowledge the fact that humanity hasn't stopped growing. Okay, now for a little bit of feedback about last week's episode, which was the beginning of the Zendi arc on Star Trek Enterprise. You know, I actually think Grace might have accidentally figured something very important out, when she was talking about men in drag and how they drink large drinks to make their hands look smaller, in relationship to Elizabeth Tucker. I remember when I watched that episode for the first time, it struck me a little bit how, what, Tripp suddenly has a sister? When did that happen? You know, his sister had never been mentioned before this episode. And then suddenly in this episode, he was completely distraught about the fact that his sister was dead. Okay, you know, I'll grant you that. I mean, the show had only been on the air for 2 years, so it's very possible Tripp had a sister that he just never mentioned on screen before. But the interesting thing was, he had mentioned a brother. And so when I watched this episode where he talks about his sister having died during this attack, I kept wondering, what about your brother? What about the rest of your family? I mean, if your sister lived there in Florida, does that mean that they also lived there? That they were in their hometown? Or had they moved away? I don't know, there was just no mention of it. I mean, if his brother had died in the attack, shouldn't he have mentioned that he also lost a brother? And if his brother had survived the attack, shouldn't he be off with his brother lamenting his sister's loss or something? Right? What's up with the brother? But then you think about, well, what was the one reference that we did have to Tripp's brother in the previous episode? I think the episode was the second season episode, Fusion. Tripp mentions that he learned to dance by dancing with his brother because he was really nervous about going to this dance. So the only real reference we have to Tripp's brother is this idea that when Tripp was growing up, his brother knew how to dance a lot better than he did, and knew how to dance from a woman's side of the dance, right? So I guess I'm saying that maybe the truth that Grace has accidentally stumbled upon in her discussion of men in drag is that Tripp's sibling is a transsexual. He started out as a brother when Tripp was younger, but the brother's not around anymore, and now he has the sister. Is it possible that Tripp's brother is now Tripp's sister? And that's why he doesn't talk about having a brother anymore? I think so. In fact, I'm going to just believe that from now on in my own personal canon. You guys mentioned how the second season finale of Enterprise, at the end of that episode, there was this major conflict with the Klingons, and it just sort of tied up the whole Klingon thing nicely at the end of the episode, because you needed some action at the end of an episode. Sure, whatever. Personally, I didn't like the whole Klingon story, and I wasn't that into it, so it was nice to have it done. But it is interesting to note that Season 3 of Star Trek Enterprise is the only season of Star Trek ever that has not a single Klingon character appear. Keep up the good work, you guys. Data out.